Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything. They don't have trust. They don't trust each other. You can't trust each other if you don't have a community. A community comes first. Once you get a community and you get to know people, then you move up to the next level, you trust them. Once you learn how to trust people, then you move up to the third level, you begin to cooperate with them. And once you learn how to cooperate with them, then you get to the fourth level, you start to hold them accountable for what they're doing wrong. The same thing in business. In business, you're building a business operation, and competitiveness and power dynamics is a five-story building. The first thing you all should be doing, as I said, get you some institutions like the chamber and started teaching, acquiring wealth and power through operating businesses. If you build an economy, that's a five-story building. The first floor must always be economics. Always build an economy before you do everything else. The first floor is the economy. The second floor is politics. The third floor is the court and police departments, the enforcement system. The fourth floor is the media. The fifth floor is schools. Now again, you've been bamboozled on that because they keep telling you that you go send black folks to school, go jump to the fifth floor and try to come back down. Education can't do nothing. Education is just a tool. You start with your economy. Once you build an economy, a viable, competitive economy, by making your money circulate 8 to 12 times, you take that money and you move to the second floor. The second floor is your politicians. Don't worry about voting. You don't have to vote. People that got money, whether it's organized crime or wealthy people, they don't have to vote. You take your money on the first floor and you buy every politician on the second floor. And if you can't buy them, you rent or lease them.
And once you rent a lease to those politicians or buy them on the second floor, you make hold them accountable to go to the third floor. And you stop the police from shooting and killing black folk all the time and come up with new codes of conduct. Then once you get to the third floor and get the police and court system straight, because you can now effectuate it, then you go to the fourth floor. The fourth floor means media. You cannot own television stations, radio stations, and daily newspapers if you don't have an economy. I hear black folk crying all the time. I have two radio stations. I used to have four. You cannot have a media operation unless you have an economy. Who's going to buy your time, your ads? You got to have an economy to buy the time. And so you got it. Right now we have 12,000 radio stations in the United States. We got about 12,000 cable systems, 5,000 daily newspapers, 5,000 TV stations. Black folk own 0.0005%. You can't even communicate. You can't communicate, you can't organize. You can't get communication because you don't have an economy. And once you get enough money, you put your medium up at the fourth floor. Then lastly, you tell the fifth floor, which is a school system, say, here's what we want. We don't want any more black basketball players or football players. Every black right now, a successful black, has got some kind of an illicit relationship with a ball. He's either running with a tennis ball, basketball, golf ball, football, sitting on jokes, telling jokes, pretending he's having a ball. Just get away from that. And say, from now on, you've got to raise kids that can produce something. The producers will be the people survive. Right now, black folk are zero producers and 100% consumers. You're going to get totally wiped out on this country and wiped off the face of the earth under globalization if you don't learn how to produce vertically. You produce something at the bottom level, then you go up and have other blacks come in over you. Like I'm producing fish, 1 million pounds of fish a year, I want blacks to come in and warehouse, wholesale, distributor, then retail. I want to see some black lobster restaurants in the country. And you build, and I have about two more minutes I got. Now, and you build these vertical orders based on your competitive advantages. Start build your businesses where you have a competitive advantage. What are your competitive advantages, black folk? Always build your business where you dominate in population or you dominate in spending patterns. I built the seafood factories. Why? Because blacks eat 3 to 4 times more seafood than whites. And you spend $9 for every $1 white spend. You should be controlling the seafood industry. Do the same thing with leather. You do the same thing with your hair. Right now, blacks are the only people got a certain quality of hair. And yet the Koreans are controlling black hair care in America. And you want to build these businesses like the difference between Detroit and Chinatown. You got it in Chinatown in New York. In Chinatown, New York, they got about a little less than 300,000 Chinese there. And again, in Detroit, you had almost a million blacks. I looked at the two and compared them. What in Chinatown, they had 35 banks, 35 Asian banks. Detroit, they got two black banks, and that's owned by the same one. How is it almost a million people don't have two banks, and 300,000 have 35 banks? I looked at the number of restaurants. The Asians had almost 400-some restaurants in New York. Black folks in Detroit had three. I said, how do these Asians producing so well and have so much, and they got, and Asians have the highest median family income in America. Here's what they do in conclusion. They build around their advantage. What is it that Asians eat most of? They eat noodles. I went and found something like about 100 and some noodle factories in New York where they produce their own noodles. Now, once they produce the noodles, what do you put on the noodles? They put a sauce on the noodles. I found about another 60 or 70 companies that produce the sauce to go on the noodles. And I said, what else are they producing? Then when I found that they had, I don't know how many, 35 or 40 companies that make the little fortune cookies. They take care of their own people. That's why you'll never see Asians, Arabs, Hispanic, or American Indians out marching for integration or for social civil rights. They don't do it. They build businesses. I love you all. Take care.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right. Today, here on DIY Housing TV, this is a little holdover from yesterday. Today's live stream is titled, at least the jump off title, Is It Competition or Discrimination? Once again, is it competition or discrimination? And I've got some visual aids for you. If you're on, well, you have to be online to listen to us anyway. Go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV. That's DIY Housing TV, that's our Facebook page. Full title, man, on Facebook is DIY Housing TV at Earth Wealth Forest. But if you just put in DIY Housing TV, that should bring up. All right, so the first, if you just scroll down, we've got a little picture display, which let me go to that right now. So I can sort of instruct you. Okay. So there's a map, actually three maps. It's a total of five pictures. No, excuse me, one, two, three, four, well, five, six pictures. The one in the upper left-hand part of the that little box there we have, that's under Vauban Schwarzwald, okay. It's titled, Nobody Lives Here. Nobody Lives Here. I want you to tap on that. And it's got two pictures within one. One is the lower 48 of the United States. And the bottom picture where it says no one lives here, you have a picture of Alaska. Okay. Now, the green areas on these maps is where no one lives there. So from that map, or these two maps, you'll see that there's a lot of empty space in what we call the United States of America. Those green areas represent where, it's crickets. That's it. No one lives there. All right, so we'll scroll down. Let's scroll down to the next picture. And then you have a world map, and those pink areas, okay, those pink areas, no one lives there, all right? And, we'll comment on that. And we scroll down to the next picture. Well, you see the whole nation of Canada, and Canada has a larger landmass than the United States. You'll see in Canada, all of those green areas, no one lives there. All right. And then we scroll down. A picture below that is a gavel in a sign that says discrimination. And the two pictures below that, you see a couple of foot races. Okay, now. Let's bring some numbers into this. Okay. And one of the numbers, if you're a regular to this live stream podcast, you've heard me say quite often. And I've got this in the program notes here on Blog Talk Radio, so you can see it in our scrolling marquee. All right, so, and I'm trying to give you a more accurate picture of the landscape of the United States, which I always refer to as a chessboard. In order to be good at the game of chess, the first thing you need to learn is the board. Before we even get to the players that play, but you need to be familiar with the board and how to move on it. So, all right, so, and this, once again, we're doing part of yesterday's podcast along with today. I got the visual aids. That's why I mentioned, what I just mentioned on our Facebook page. Anyway, so in the United States, there are two distinctions of communities. Now, overall, there are 40,953 communities in the United States. With about 5 to 7 popping up new a week. But 40,000, let's put the number at 40,953. That's the total community. Now, that's And the two flavors are municipal communities and unincorporated communities. All right, so the number that the regulars have heard me quote quite often on here, there are 19,500 municipal communities in the United States. Those are communities that have incorporated. They have municipal charters. They're municipal corporations. And in the United States, you've got communities that have as small as one person living in that town. You'd be surprised at the amount of towns in this country that have 1, 2, 3, maybe 10 people, citizens in there, but they exist. All right. So on up to New York City, which has, 8 to 9 million people in the city proper. New York, let's put New York City at 8.5, I'll just round it down to 8 million for the city. Of course, the metro area is about 18 million, but in the city, at least 8 million plus. Then Chicago's got about 3 million in the city. Los Angeles has got, New York's number one. I think Chicago or L.A. Is number two or three. 2 to 3 million each. And out of the 19,500 communities in the United States, only 10 within their city proper has a population of 1 million or more people. Once again, I'm laying the groundwork here because it ties into what the topic is, the jump-off topic that I'm bringing up today, which is it competition or discrimination? All right. So you got 19,000. And now, 86% of the population of the United States only occupies 3% of the land mass. All right, so now let's go back to the maps. Nobody lives here. So that 86% lives the white areas, white in color on that map. Not people, but they're spread out within the white areas. As you can see, green dominates because most people in the economy, nobody lives it. All right. So 86% of the United States, that's, the white areas, not people, but on that map, they're crammed into that. Okay. Okay, now, next, unincorporated communities. These are communities that, before I even go to that, municipal communities offer municipal services. A municipal service is a police department, a fire department, a water department, a library, in many cases, but they offer municipal services. Those municipal services, in order to make the payroll for the police department and the equipment that they need, and the social services office, EBT, food stamps, these are all municipal services. It's paid for, it's bankrolled primarily by the taxpayers, that the citizens that live in that particular town. Could be New York City, could be El Cajon, California, could be Seattle, Washington, but that's how they pay for those municipal services. Typically, it's more expensive to live in a municipal town versus a non-municipal, unincorporated town. Now, there's some exceptions to this, because if you're in a small town that might have a population of 1,000 or less people, there's not enough tax base there to do that. All right. So, like, for instance, I like to go to some towns that, quite often that have less than 400 people. So in those towns that might have a municipal charter, there's not enough people, there's not enough tax base to have a police department or have a fire department, a municipal fire department. They might have a volunteer fire department, but not a municipal one paid for by the taxpaying citizens of that particular state, I mean city, not state but city. Okay. Now, unincorporated, there are more unincorporated communities in the United States than there are municipal corporations. There are 21,553 unincorporated communities in the United States. Typically, it's less expensive to live in these towns. And 48% of the country, okay, cities, 48% of the communities in the United States are unincorporated. All right. And that's where about 14% of the population is spread out among those 21,453 unincorporated communities in the United States. Now, you don't have any million, you don't have any towns that have an unincorporated place that have a million people, but a lot of them have 5,000 people or less. Matter of fact, 48% of the population of the United States, they live in these little, well, small towns, 5,000 people. Matter of fact, not the last election, the election where Donald Trump won the presidency, he didn't win the popular vote, but he won the electoral college vote. All right, because the electoral college counts the little people in the little towns that have a population of 5,000 to 10,000 people or less. So if you're in now, and we have to take this in consideration, if you track when somebody runs for president of the United States, they basically campaign, and you got 50 states. I can't think of not one person who's run for president who's ever campaigned physically in all 50 states. What they'll do is they'll target particular cities or particular regions that have a large population base and go to those places. But you won't hear about them being probably in Nome, Alaska, which has a little bit over 3,000 people, or Whittier, Alaska, which has less than 400 people, or Summit, Oklahoma, which has maybe about 100 people. You typically don't give a campaign speech in those places but the Electoral College, they count those people, and that's how you get, people get elected. It's not the popular vote that gets you in, but the Electoral College that gets you in. And that's where nearly half of the population of the United States lives. But it's spread out. Once again, let's go to that chessboard. I'll give you a vision on it. On a chessboard, has 67 spaces, 67 spaces, blocks. 3% of that is just 2 squares. That's it. So you have 86% of the population of the United States that is crammed into those 2 squares. Now, I'm saying all that to say, this leads us to today's title, why I name things, this title, Competition or Discrimination. All right, so when you have 86% of a population, no matter what they look like, they can be all the same color, all the same race, all the same sex. When you have 86% of a population crammed into 2 squares on that chessboard, it's competitive. Then the laws of supply and demand kick in. All right, it's going to cost more to live in this particular area because of the there's a lot of demand, but not that much supply. So is it competition or discrimination? You know, people say, well, redlining is a way to discriminate. Now, once again, if you have a whole bunch of people, pick any large city that you've gone to, Chicago, Seattle, Washington, Los Angeles, California, Washington, D.C., Miami, Florida, New York City, and drive 60 miles outside of that. Or if you ever been on an airplane and, you know, you're looking out the window on takeoff and you're leaving from a highly densely populated area where most airports are, all right, you'll know within a matter of minutes, and we're talking about less than five, maybe even 2 to 3, as you're ascending, the further you go up and you still see the ground clearly, there are less buildings, there are less cars, and you see rural land below you. You can fly sometimes for hours, depending on where you're going. And when you look down, there's no one there other than trees and landscape and that type of thing. Just take note of that the next time you take a flight somewhere, particularly if it's a long-haul flight. I took a flight once from JFK up in New York City, and I was going to Beijing. And we got off. It didn't take us long to get off there. We had to fly. Because to get from New York to Beijing, they typically fly over, not over the North Pole directly, but close to the Arctic Circle. So once we flew out, and JFK is in a densely populated city, New York City. So as we flew up, pretty soon it was just farmland. And then we kept on going, and you get into Canada, and if you look on the map that we have on our Facebook page, once again, no one lives here. And it's scroll down, there's a whole map of the whole nation of Canada, and it's mostly green. So you're looking down, no one lives there. And then, you know, you fly over, then you get over Russia, and then you go into Beijing, which is a densely populated city. So there, once again, is it discrimination or competition? So I'm saying that redlining is not discrimination. It's a matter of geography. You need to know the landscape. So if you want to move to an area where you don't have a problem with so-called discrimination, it's like, once again, it's not discrimination. It's a matter of geography. Go to a place where you have little or no competition. And those are the areas where you have small populations, or in some cases, no population. It's the same thing that runs with business. As a matter of fact, there's some food for thought. Billionaires. They're less than, we got 8 billion people on the planet, and they're less than 4,000 billionaires on the planet. Matter of fact, let me look up the number. And this is all dealing with what we're talking about today. Is it competition or is it discrimination? So number of billionaires in the world. That's what we're going out in the world. Okay. On planet Earth, there are 2,640 billionaires. Once again, out of 8 billion people and counting, there are 2,640 billionaires on the planet. How did they become, because people buy books on this, I'm going to save some money on how they did, how they do it. typically people who are billionaires, not all. Now, I'm eliminating the ones who inherited their money. I'm not including them. Okay. But like first generation billionaires. All right. Like, I'll throw out some names. All right. Jay-Z, the entertainer, the rapper, married to Beyonce, he's a billionaire. Aliko Dangote, a Nigerian businessman from Africa, is the richest black person on the planet. He's a billionaire. Both are first-generation billionaires. All right. Rihanna, the singer, first-generation billionaire from Barbados. Subway sandwiches. Now, the guy who started that, the DeLuca family owns it now, but the guy who started it, I forgot his first name, so I'm going to just say Paul DeLuca. Billionaire. First generation. There's a guy, Kavanaugh, Mr. Kavanaugh. He started a company called, and he franchises called Johnny King. Billionaire. The late Ray Kroc, before he passed, a milkshake salesman, he came across the McDonald's brothers when he was 55 years old, and he was selling milkshake machines. Died a billionaire. Now, the common denominator, and we may as well throw in the late Sam Walton. How did he become a billionaire in his lifetime? All right, number one, none of them did it through any type of government subsidy program. So let's just wipe that off the board. The common denominator, from what I can see, is number one, you know what, I'm throwing another person in. Fred C. Trump, Donald Trump's father, billionaire. All right, now, the common denominator with all the people I just named and practically every billionaire, including Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, the common denominator, now, once again, we're not including inherited wealth. These are for every name that I mentioned are first-generation billionaires. And once again, they're less than 3,000 out of 8 billion people on the planet. How they do it, the common denominator is they got into something where they were essentially pioneers. And typically, if you're a pioneer or one of the pioneers of a particular industry, there's little or no government regulation. And there's two more people I want to bring up. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, and Bill Gates. Now, Facebook, and once again, I say the common denominator is they're pioneers, or one of the beginning pioneers in something. And typically, when you're a pioneer, there's little or no government regulation. Facebook is a glorified website. That's all it is. You don't need a business license to start a website. You think of a domain name, you go register the domain name, that can be as little as $2.50. Depends on what service you use, you know, to register the name. But Facebook, anybody can do the same thing. And a lot of people have. Bill Gates, little or no government regulation. Now, I'm not talking about after they going public. Because once you go public on Wall Street and everything, you're regulated then. But I'm talking about essentially these guys amassed a huge fortune, before they went public. Airbnb, which is an app. You know, to my knowledge, apps are not regulated. Thus explains Uber, you know, they haven't figured out how to regulate that. So Rihanna with her beauty it's probably a little government regulation there. So they got into areas where there was little or no competition. So that once again, going back to the title I came up here with today, is it discrete competition? You know, DeLuca with the Subway sandwiches. You know, you don't need to have a license to know how to make a sandwich. Okay, so what these people did, they got into something that would require little or no government regulation. And they just amped it up. And that this is where I go to Fred C. Trump, Donald Trump's dad. He had two basic cookie cutter models. He was a builder. He started at 15. He took some carpentry classes. His two primary cookie cutters, he did some other things, but his two primary bread and butter cookie cutters is he built a house that retailed that sold for $3,999 and another one that he built and sold for $4,999 way back when. Now, you can still do that today. You just have to look at, but you need to do it in those green areas, pink areas on those maps I posted up on our Facebook page. Anyway, but the thing is, he did it over, he built and sold those two bread and butter models over 27,000 times. The guy who came up with the Subway, the restaurant carryout called Subway Sandwiches, all right, you don't need a license to make a sandwich. Okay. Now, to open up a business, you did. But what he did is he franchised it. He franchised it thousands of times or hundreds of times. In his case, thousands of times. He's gone, but you know, the Luca family still run that. So the common denominator, you know, Jay-Z, I mean, to get into the entertainment business, virtually any aspect of it, is little or no government regulation involved. But the highly regulated industries like banking and insurance, you're really not going to find billionaires in those places. But typically, once again, just be aware of the concept. Is it competition or discrimination? Even with, and I brought this up yesterday, Black Wall Street, the Tulsa race riots, was that a matter of discrimination or competition? And I brought up, you know, matter of fact, let me do a parallel. Eatonville, Florida, which is about 45 minutes away from me, 6 miles outside of Orlando, they've been around, that's like the oldest incorporated black township in the United States, have never had a lick of trouble when it comes to race. So what did they do that did not incur any problems racially versus Black Wall Street, the Greenwood neighborhood in 1921? Well, I gave you part of the answer yesterday, because in Oklahoma, they probably had 100 black communities, but they were in areas. That's why I used the chessboard analogy. They were in areas where there was no competition. Eatonville, Florida, which is 45 minutes away from me, 6 miles outside of Orlando, they built in an area where there's no competition. They were left alone. They went through the lynching period here in the United States, no problems. The Jim Crow area in the United States, no problems. Today, no problems. Because they built in an area where nobody was going to bother them. They had no competition. They weren't competing against everybody. Whereas with Black Wall Street, they set up camp within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then you're on the grid and you got competition. And what happened? So once again, ask the question, is it discrimination or competition? Whether it be where you're going to live or what kind of business that you're going to get into, I recommend get into something that has little, get into or live in or near some place that has little or no competition, and you'll be able to dominate. And that's essentially what billionaires have done. They found a little niche. They found a pond or a lake where there's no other fishermen. And then they just dominate. All right, anyway, that's about as simplified as I can be. That's my day. If you guys want to throw anything in here, and like I say, the maps on our it's DYI Housing TV. Look at the areas that when I buy a piece of land or something, I buy agricultural zone land. Why do I buy agricultural zone land over residential land? Because I have more freedom. There's more people that live in the city versus that live in the country. So if you ever want to run into me, you'll find me, if you do, in the green areas on those maps, or on the global maps, the pink areas. Those are the areas that I frequent where there's little or no competition of anything. And then oftentimes, it doesn't take you that long to, you know, transport yourself from, you know, if you got a car, some of these places, you can go from green or pink to the more populated areas within 15 to 20 minutes. Sometimes it might be 2 hours, sometimes it might be three hours. But there are plenty of spaces where you can go. All right. So, once again, that's my rant for today. So I believe there's really no such thing as discrimination. In my world, according to the stats that I put out to you, in my world, there's no discrimination. I'm a black dude. There's no discrimination because I don't go to the places that have heavy competition for a place to live. There's no discrimination, no redlining. I don't need affirmative action. I don't need special set-asides. I don't need all those in competitive environments. I shy away from competitive environments. So I'm finding my way back to the studio here. Of course, now that's the way I see things with my rose-colored glasses. So, but you might see it differently. If you, and we got some people that have comments on this, which is good. Let's go to the first one, area code 309. Your mic is open.
Good morning, L.A. Yeah, I was sitting there looking.
Good morning, Chris.
Looking at these maps that you got on Facebook, and there's a lot of land. That is the reality of getting to see what you've been talking about. So I appreciate that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there are loads of places. I'll give an example. I have a house in Washington, D.C., and the property taxes on it is over $5,000, you know, a year. And it took me quite a while to get the squatter out. That's why I started this podcast, 9 years ago. But D.C., which in my opinion is trying to make it into another Manhattan, New York, D.C. is just really not that big, maybe 10 square miles, something like that. And you got over 600,000 people. You know, you got people that are renting rooms. You got people that are that can make $40,000 or $50,000 a year that are renting rooms because they can't afford to buy a house in most parts of the city. So I live in Florida, though. I'm here in Florida. You know, I've got, like, I'm on a quarter, no, three-quarters of acre land where I'm at right now. But I got 4 acres about 3 hours away from me. Because why? I bought land here. Most of the places I'll buy land is in those green areas on the map. Now, it's in a census-designated area. The Census Bureau doesn't even have a count on how many people live in, well, I have that 4 acres, which we call Earthwell Forest. So, but it's not far from civilization. It's a little, you know, maybe a 15-minute drive to I-10 and I-75 in a Walmart, a hospital, and all that kind of stuff. That's why I preach so much of off the grid. Because when you're on the grid, you're regulated. Matter of fact, if people want to take an interesting study of wealth, look, go back in time to the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. Most of the men who signed that document were wealthy people. And the difference between July 4th, 1776 and July 4th, 2023, which is, will be here soon, is that those guys who got wealthy, there was no local, state, or federal government at that time. Let's go to July 3rd, 1776. They didn't have to deal with the DMV. They didn't have to deal with a lot of government agencies that exist now on a local, state, and federal level didn't exist then. So the least amount of regulation, the easier it is to live free and do what you want to do. Today, you just have to look. There are opportunities available. There are a lot of opportunities still available today. You know, cyberspace, governments haven't figured out how to regulate that yet. They're trying, though. I mean, because if you look at it, how did President Obama get elected? Well, when he got into the race, and it appeared that he had limited funds, he didn't have the war chest of the old Boyd Network. But what he did have, he had a group, he surrounded himself with people who knew the landscape of social media. So he used, so that's how, in my opinion, that's how he won. He got elected the first time and second time. How did Trump get in? Trump, no matter what people think about him or say about him, the guy's he's a master of media, particularly social media as well. So we've had, you know, Obama 8 years and Trump another 4. So we've got 12 consecutive years where the old boy money network, they didn't know social media. And social media is still in its, in my opinion, it's still in its pioneer phase. I mean, you got 20-year-olds who know how to travel hack, you know, who've been to every country on the planet. They're not even 25 years old yet. So there's a lot of opportunity out there. And there, I mean, there are jobs and professions that are popping up on the daily that they weren't even invented 24 hours ago, even last week. So once again, look at, you know, is it competition or is it discrimination? So that's how I look at it. I look for areas where there's little or no competition.
No, and that's a good place to be looking.
Anyway, Chris.
No, that's a good place to be looking. You know, why have competition? And, you know, why live on top of each other?
Yeah. I mean, like we had on Monday, what's his name, Pastor
Slade. Pastor Slade.
Yes, Pastor Slade, who was on Monday. Yeah, Pastor Slade, he no competition.
Right.
No competition.
And then they didn't even go for funding because they own the land. It didn't cost them anything other than putting the structures there to start helping people.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, imagine if he or anybody, me and you, imagine if you did that 1,000 times or 4,000 times or 10,000 times.
Exactly.
You know. So
the second you duplicate anything, you start a multiplicity.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, and we'll have him back on, and then we'll, of course, you've got some things going as well. So that's how you hit those 6 and 7 figure days. Taking something as simple as Pastor Strand had on, talking about Monday, and thus replicating it. Wash, repeat, and more. Right.
Yeah, wash, repeat, and repeat.
What's
wash, rinse, and repeat.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. I mean, he laid out a blueprint that's just pretty simple, that anybody can do. And as he stated, he didn't know anything about anything other than pastoring the church. He didn't know anything about construction, tiny houses,
yep,
villages, nothing. But he laid it out Monday, so you can't get any simpler than that, the blueprint. Let's take another call here real quick. Oh, wait a minute. Go ahead. I'm
listening
first.
No, I'm just saying, it's beautiful. You know, you got somebody that just cares and had to be directed. You know, they also gave him directions that were going to set him up to fail because every person they put in front of him before, they gave him the same directions. They all directed themselves to something else. And the only thing we can get this done. What was that, brother? Go ahead.
Oh, no, I think, he mentioned, whoever was telling him that, he said, whatever you do, don't quit. And they did that during the pandemic. Yeah, it took them 2 years to... with the pandemic and everything, it took, 2 years to pull that off, but, now they've got it done, and then now he did it, El Cajon, now, once again, out of the 40,000 communities in the United States, 40,000 plus, out of the 19,500 that are municipal, and El Cajon is a municipality in California. So, El Cajon, California is like the 200th, and matter of fact, let me get accurate on this. Let me not guess. El Cajon, California. Where I'm looking for which bureau here is. Let's see. El Cajon has a population of 106,215 people. All right. It is the 67th largest city in the state of California. That's just in the state of California. It's the 67th largest city in the state of California. So it ain't even in the top 50 in California. And in the United States, it's the 298th largest city in the United States. okay, 298th largest city in the United States. That's out of, well, we throw the whole kit and caboodle in there. That's out of 40,000 cities, I mean towns in the United States. So this guy's like, if he's not a pioneer, who is? He's a pioneer. So essentially, if you replicate, and you go to this past, we record all of our podcasts. If you replicate, now he just did it with six. He's in at six so far. And he told you what, because they've got some practice with it now. You know, they can duplicate what they did in a weekend. They can do that in a weekend now. But imagine if that's done 1,000 times, 5,000 times, or 10,000 times. Because that's all Ray Kroc did with McDonald's. That's all any company or person who, you know, as you mentioned, Chris, the multiplier effect, when you really step up those numbers, you know, you're, once again, is there discrimination? Now, look at it this way, too. Is there more competition? Now think of Pastor Strand, Roland Strand, the person who might be homeless or might be looking for a job. Is there more competition? Because a lot of times when you go to a shelter, there are no beds available. That's, you're going into a competitive environment. Or if you're looking for a job, it's a competitive environment. But if you switch to the other side of the table, instead of saying, okay, I need a place, you know, can I get into the Salvation Army? Can I get into the shelter? If you go to the other side of the table, if you leave yourself from the possible discriminatory or competitive part, and you go to, you know what, I'm going to, I mean, there are 30,000, excuse me, there are 3,000 counties in the United States. Now, imagine, let's take what Pastor Strand talked about Monday. And we have that whole thing recorded. It's about an hour and a half podcast that we did on it. Just look it up. Meridian Tiny House. Meridian Tiny House Village. That's, look it up in our archives and listen to that hour and a half interview. He's got six cabins and for the homeless. The proper name for them are not tiny houses, but the proper name for what he did is emergency sleeping cabins. Six cabins, and let's multiply by, let's say he just did that one time, of course, with Boots on the Ground partner, in every county in the United States. Now, there are 31. I'm going to just round it down to 3,000. 6,000 times, that's 18,000 cabins. And let's say, now, they're not charging anything. But let's say he went entrepreneurial and said, well, okay, $500 a month rent. That's $9 million per month. $108 million a year. That's just off of Monday's podcast. He built six. He's got a small church, maybe 55, 60, 70 people attend his church services on Sunday. Now, what most people do, you know, I mean, because six isn't a large number. Most people won't do that because most people are conditioned to go into a competitive environment. And when you get into a competitive environment, that's when things like You know, people start using words like discrimination, redlining, you know, is this set aside, and, you know, they want reparations. All those are competitive words. All I'm saying is look for where there's little or no competition and then do what you need to do. Now, he did it in El Cajon. El Cajon, once again, out of 40,000-plus communities in the United States. He didn't do it out in Los Angeles or San Francisco. He's not too far from San Diego. It happened in El Cajon, the 267th largest city in the United States, out of 40,000-plus. If you want to find affordable living for housing, if you want to start, it's a whole lot of things you can do when you go to areas of competition or little or no competition.
Yeah, the ones that
one example before I go to the next caller. Well, what were you saying, Chris?
I was going to say, you know, for one example of that, we have service industries that are coming to you. So even if you're rural, they will deliver. And
right.
You can get basically everything. You know, you talked about getting your groceries and stuff delivered the other day. This happens. So just because you don't live across the street from the amenity doesn't mean that the amenity won't get on the street and come to you.
You're absolutely right, because I'm an app guy. I do half my grocery shopping by app. I'll order groceries or whatever. If the app's on my phone, be it Walmart or a sandwich place or whatever, if it's an app on a phone, I have them bring it to me. Like yesterday, Amazon. You know, every month I get something from Amazon. And, you know, you order it, and then they just bring it to your door. So that's the world we live in. Even before apps, the companies that were doing home delivery, because you had a lot of little Chinese restaurants that they were doing home delivery for decades before anybody had apps or whatever. You know, Pizza Hut, they were doing delivery as well. So, because not everybody, you know, wants to go in or whatever. So, anyway, hold on, Chris. We're going to our next caller. Area code 254. Your mic is open.
Good morning.
254. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, so you make an interesting thought there, because I never thought about the competition or discrimination. And I guess if you're in competition, if you have siblings, you got competition right out the gate.
True.
So then you have competitiveness. Yeah, so then you have a competitive situation right away. So then when you apply to the bigger countryside or country or groups of people, you still have that competition. So,
true.
So out of the competitiveness will come your discrimination, because you're just trying to get ahead of the next guy. You don't want that person
exactly
to outdo you. Yeah. So that's where you discrimination
right.
to come out of the competitiveness. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. So, and once you recognize that, you know, if you look at the landscape, that's why I use the chessboard as an analogy. Once you look at the landscape, you say, all right, wait a minute. All right, well, there's so much more over here. Well, let me go over this place, and there's no competition. But a lot of people don't. They get tunnel vision. They just lie. But you're right. Right out the gate, because I dated a woman once. She was one of 12. One of 12 siblings. You know, getting your parents' attention, and you know, there's a competitive there. And then some, you know, some children, some siblings, if you show up late, there's nothing to eat, you know. So it, my mother, she was one of seven, all right, and they were on welfare when she was young. So her bedroom was the kitchen. But she didn't mind her bedroom being in the kitchen because she had access over to other siblings for the food.
Yep.
You know, so you're right. Right out the gate, if you got siblings, that compared nature, you know, it's there.
Right.
Until your vision gets a lot larger. Go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, so then it's just like the government, in a way, kind of becomes your parent. So how does your parent manage those things, you know? So I know that there's three of us, and I remember one Christmas, we only got one toy. We got a truck. And the three of us had to play with this one truck. And we started fighting over that truck. My father said, y'all settle down, y'all share. So a few minutes later, we started again. My father took that truck and threw it out. He said, now, play with that. There was nothing to play with. So you had to get along with each other. So he sell that real quick, you know. So whenever we started squabbling over something, he would go take it away. So we knew not to argue over things because it would get taken away. So we didn't do a lot of arguing over things. If somebody got something, if one of my brothers got something, I didn't go try and take it away from him because then I know it's going to be taken away, period, for all of us, whatever, you know. So they squashed it right away. So then the same thing with the government. So how's the government going to manage people fussing with each other? Well, that's when you got all these different social services. You got police. You got whatever else to try and manage people to keep them from acting up. But as we know, the history of man in general is – they act up. You don't make laws unless somebody's done something that's so disgusting you make a law for it.
Right.
Or out of bounds or whatever. So you try and keep people wrangled in so they act, so they behave themselves. So,
That's true. And you're absolutely right because, right. It's like, for instance, the larger the population, I'll give you an example. When two cities that I've traveled to in Oklahoma, a town that was right near us in college, Happy, Texas. Man, I've only passed through Happy, so I don't know what kind of setup they have there. But like in Taft, Oklahoma, where I've been to, Taft has a population of under 350 people. Summit, Oklahoma has a population of probably around 100 people or so, 150 tops. In those two towns, there's no, and they're both municipalities, but they don't have a police department. Why? Because the people in those towns feel they don't need, well, first thing, they don't have a tax base. They don't want to pay for one. Okay. So, and then everybody knows everybody in those towns. So they necessarily don't need a police department. They can handle things, or they've been handling things for over 100 years because everybody knows everybody. Whereas if you go to a larger city that has, like Muskogee, which might have 50,000 people, so I don't know what the population is, but it's dramatically larger than Taft or Summit, Oklahoma. They have a police department because it's just a lot more people And the larger it gets, the less people that know each other and that you can settle things without going. Because the Taft and Summit, they don't have a police department. They don't have a court. They don't need it because they're, for all practical purposes, self-governing. But the larger the population, then that's when the police come, if you feel you need those services, you move to those towns. Now, one particular thing I don't like in modern society is, and I don't have a silver bullet answer for it, is there's a lot of domestic violence out there, but that really happens you notice it more in your larger towns. So you have some people now, if they don't like what you say, they'll call the police, and the police come out for a domestic situation when there might not have been any physical violence at all, but, they're settling household disputes or whatever. But it's the individual thing, it's subjective or whatever.
Also, you notice that right now the economy's doing fairly well. People are working. So you have less fighting going on because, well, they're working. And so then if you have people working, then everything else tends to go down. Your crime rate tends to go down. Your domestic violence drops down because now there's money. And
And
you can buy your significant other a new dress.
That'll help.
Yeah, but let the economy take a dive. And people get unemployed again, you're going to see a lot more finger pointing and over the pandemic, the domestic violence went up at first. I mean, it went down at first, and then it went up closer to the end of the pandemic. There was more of it. Not only domestic violence against the spouse, but against the kids, too, because, they couldn't go to work. They're trapped in the house together. Everybody felt trapped. So then they start lashing out at the people that's closest to them.
True. Now you're in Texas. Now, Texas is an interesting state because Texas has over 200 counties in that state, and then three of the largest cities in the United States, even in the world population, are in Texas. You got San Antonio, you have Dallas, and you have Houston, and then when you throw in, what do they call it, the Golden Triangle? Throw in Austin, because Austin, Texas, I believe, is knocking at the door of a million. They have over 900,000 people, I think, that live in Austin. So, however, now with that said, go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, I would say Austin's growing almost 100,000 a year.
Yeah, they're going to be hitting a million soon. Probably within the next year or so. Yeah. Definitely by the next census, they would have hit it.
That's a good example of your so that population explosion, because Austin didn't grow for a while, but the last 30 years, it's been a boom town. And for a while, it was the number one place in the country to start a business because
the population
was growing.
Okay.
Yeah, for about... in the early 2000s, I know for sure, early 2000s to maybe 2005 or 6, it was the number one place to start a business because it's just boomtown. You know, you could just make money there. And the way it's growing, and they're talking about it's sinking because so many buildings are going up downtown, particularly 30-story high rises. Going up all over the place. It's amazing. But but that's a good place for competition where they have a huge homeless population there. They sleep under the bridges on 35 and elsewhere. You can just thousands of tents popped up, little pop-up tents everywhere. And so they're
This is in Austin?
In Austin. And so they're trying to figure out...
Okay, all right.
Where can they ship them off to? Where can they move them to? And there's not very many places to move them to. And a lot of the homeless there are people that are, I wouldn't say a lot, but a good portion of them are people that want to make it in the music business. because Austin's another, it's one of the places where musicians come out of there, and, you know, a lot of musicians come out of Austin. And so, but almost every one of them can
play
a guitar.
Well, now, you brought up something. You brought up something, right? When you put out where they're going to ship them to, now, once again, Texas, if we look at the landscape of Texas, Texas has over 200 counties. And once you step outside of the Austin metro area, the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, Houston and San Antonio, once you step outside of those areas, like if you go to the Panhandle or West Texas, and I'm talking about extreme West Texas, I'm talking about El Paso and the counties east of El Paso.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of space out there.
Well, yeah, and those areas are still the points where you can drive for an hour and not see anybody.
Exactly. Exactly. But the thing is, because when I bring this up to our classmate Milt, he says he feels safer in a larger town, whereas, because I bought 10 acres out in Presidio County, and there's nothing there but desert and mountains. And the nearest Walmart might be 2.5 hours away. But I'm all right with that because of the cost of living, dramatically jumps up, like you just mentioned it. I just saw a video yesterday. The cost of living in Austin, as well as those other cities in Texas, the big ones in Texas, is, particularly if you got Californians moving out there, the cost of living is dramatically jumped in Austin. And like you said, I never even conceived of Austin as having a homeless population where people have, in a way it's visible, with pop-up tents, but I'm glad you brought me up to speed on that.
Yeah, and that's right downtown.
I'm from the school
of thought.
Yeah,
when you exit off the highway to go downtown, that's what you're going to see. And they've been trying to move them out
for years. What about towns like Waco?
Okay, so Waco has a population downtown as well. But right now the city, that's what I was going to tell you, is that the city is enacting this plan, and they got some land. And they're going to build, like the minister had built, a village more or less. And I think they're going to house like 100 something people in this village
right.
of tiny homes. And it's with the city and with I think Mission Waco and some others. It's a group getting together. They're trying to build this homeless area, and they're wanting to do just like the minister, take them there, get them on their feet, keep them moving.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because Texas has got a lot of space where you can. Like you said, there are a lot of places in Texas where you can drive for an hour or more, and you're not going to see anybody.
Yeah. Sometimes you won't see another car.
You're absolutely right. Won't see another car, won't see a cow, won't see a horse. Texas is a very unique state, very unique state. Matter of fact, it's large enough and wealthy enough where it can actually be its own nation.
Don't say that too loud. Somebody might hear you.
But a lot of people are they're flocking to Houston, San Antonio, Austin. Like I say, Austin. I don't know when the next census is going to come out, but by the time it hits, Texas will have four out of the 10 largest cities in the United States. They already have three, but they're knocking at the door. That's a lot. That means a percentage of the United States will be living in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, there's so much there where, like I said, they're empty. There's a lot of space still in Texas, like I said, the Panhandle. Now, I haven't been to the Panhandle in quite a while because I understand up in the Panhandle, like Canyon in Texas where we were, they felt in a lot between Amarillo and Canyon. But you still got a lot of little small towns there, like Happy, Texas, Dimmitt, Texas, Pampa, Texas, Hereford, Texas. There's still a lot of little towns all laced through there, though.
I was going to ask you, you were mentioning about the Waco project that they're doing.
I can already hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? All right, is that better?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I was wondering about the Waco project. Have they started building this project, or is it under the you know, planning mode here, or getting ready
it's
to go?
Still under, from what I understand, it's still under the planning stage.
Do you have the information for the organizations that are doing this?
If you, there's two organizations involved. One of them is Mission Waco, and
Mission
Derail.
Waco.
Pastor Darrell, I think, had set up, or he used to, but he's involved in this. And he has this thing called, he does a homeless ministry, used to be Under the Bridge, and that's the name of his church, was Under the Bridge Church for a while. But anyway, they're heading up Mission Waco. You can go to missionwaco.org. To find them there.
Mission Waco. Okay, perfect.
And the name of this church was what? Under the Bridge Church?
That's what I think it's, Under the Bridge Church. I went there a couple times, and that's because all the homeless were living underneath the bridge, so he put his church underneath the bridge, and he just put chairs and stuff up on Sunday and have their speakers and everything, and then when the church is over, they take everything away.
Man, I'll be calling you this afternoon. Man, what a car. I like that concept. It's practical.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Under the bridge.
Jimmy Darrell.
There's innovation out there.
Yeah, Jimmy Darrell is his name. Yeah.
Jimmy Darrell.
Jimmy Darrell, okay.
Darrell.
Oh, we'll break hold it. Run that back. Give us a visual on that again.
What's that?
You said you attended some of one of those services or whatever.
Yes.
So this guy was set up shop under a bridge.
Well. That's what he was doing. He can't do that anymore. They've redone 35. They redid the bridges and all this stuff under 35 now. But prior to the renovation that they've done or redoing of the roads, whatever, make them wider and all that stuff. But he'd have church under the bridge, and they would have probably 100 people there, homeless, for church under the bridge, and they would give them breakfast before service and they sit there and they do the service, and then because our church participated in that, and we helped provide breakfast one morning, and that's what we did. It we went there and we did the breakfast, and anyway, they'd have a regular church service right there, put the chairs out and everything, and set your speakers up, and they were ready to go.
Man,
and in 1 hour. And it's all over in like an hour. Everything's over.
And they break it all down and see you next week.
That's right. But they also provide They also provide clothes. They run a mission, Mission Waco. So they run a mission as well. And so they're not just preaching to them and leaving them. They're actually providing the service. You know, they're...
Right.
Yeah. I want to share one other thing. I'm going to hang up after that, or you can turn me off or whatever. But along with the homeless there, I worked at the college there in town, Texas State Technical College. And anyway, in one of the video classes, we give kids projects to go out and shoot these projects. So one did about the homeless, but they did about the homeless that live underground. So almost every city has an underground homeless population. What you see above ground, it may just be a fraction underground. So in the underground of Waco, the city of Waco, in the sewers, in those giant sewer pipes or whatever, back up underneath there, there's homeless people living up underneath there. And so one of the kids in this class went and did a video about this. And they shot underground a couple places. But the people that live under there didn't want their faces shown, and they didn't want them to say where they were underground because they're afraid, you know, the cops come get them or whatever. But there are communities that live underground in the sewer pipes of the city. And I said, if it's going on in Waco, it's going on in other cities also. But those are people you can't see, and most of them don't come out until night.
Right. I heard about that in New York City.
Dwelling underground. Yeah. They dwell underground most of the time. I mean, mostly during the day, they're out of sight. And then they come out at night and forage for food or whatever. Some of them are out during the day, but they live underground.
Okay. Well, noted. I took notes. I'll be calling you this afternoon. We're going to take a quick break here. So if you got a hit-to-head or whatever, do it now. Get your coffee, juice, water. We'll be back soon.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man. I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't, like, hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code. And the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV. I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday. And I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. Said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. Club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in the dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock. Man, I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduce myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie. Then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass. Then he went back to them jokes. And they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. And they paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on a Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Okay, we're back. That was an excellent idea we got from Willie. The Upper Bridge Church, man, that's a heck of an outreach. A heck of an outreach in something the model. Area code 314, your mic is open.
L.A.
Yes, sir.
You bought land. Where is it at?
Florida, Hamilton County, Florida, Texas, Presidio County, Oklahoma, Muskogee County.
What are you doing with it?
Right now, the first
you just speculated. What about the place? What about the building?
Yeah, but
in,
I'm also
Washington,
moving.
D.C.?
That house is just sitting there. I don't plan on renting that out ever.
But you pay $5,000.
I'll use it when I go to town. Huh?
You pay $5,000 a year for taxes.
On that house, yeah.
That's almost $550 a month, plus you gotta manage that, so you're talking about close to $600 a month. If you was gonna rent that out, how much would you rent it out for?
Yeah, but it ain't. I can probably get $3,500 a month off of that if I rented that house out. But see, here's the problem: the DC government, in my opinion, is very socialist. It took me three years to get the last person out, and they were a house sitter. They weren't even renters. They didn't have to pay rent. So DC
well, that's
is very
what I'm
hard
talking
to get
about.
Them
so
out.
You don't have that. You've been paying $5,000 a year on that. For about 6 years. That's $30,000.
Yep.
Now, what are you doing? So what kind of money are you making off these other properties that you got?
Well, put it this way, Bianca, without going into detail, I'm fortunate that I've been able to hold everything together.
All right, this is what I'm telling you. People buying house, buying land for speculation, hey, you do better if you put your money in stocks and options.
I don't like stocks.
But you like paying money. I'm just telling you. You know, in Africa, if you bought land and didn't do something,
I mean, stocks and bonds are options. The reason why I'm not really particular about stocks, and I know people make money from.
Let's say we're not talking about you. Let's say we talk about the average person. Average person not going to do that. If you bought land in Africa and didn't do something right away, guess what would happen? Somebody would come take it, and nothing you can do about it. Because you're just sitting, you can't leave it sit there. You got to do something with it. Ain't no such thing as speculation over there. You never own the land, really. You basically lease it.
Well, that's true. No matter what you have
on life,
you really never own
it. If you're a foreigner, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the average person. Let's leave you out of it. It ain't going to get personal. So the average person, they can't just buy land.
Even over here, even here in the United States, no matter what kind of paperwork you got with any kind of government, whether you're on the land, off the land, in the house, out the house, you really never own it because if you don't pay the taxes, guess what? They're going to auction it off. So you really never own anything.
Yeah, you're going to pay it. But see, people make improvements to land so that the improvements cover the expenses of the land. Homeless people ain't going to do nothing like that. That's why they ass is homeless. I don't even know what kind of money. How do you make money off of homeless people?
Wait a minute now.
How do they make money off of homeless people? How do they make money off of homeless people unless you're in church?
Wait a minute now. Bianca, there are different distinctions of homeless. Okay, now the type of homeless people that I would interact with, and there are plenty of them, and you find them on YouTube in abundance every day, is you do have quite a few working homeless. They have a 9-to-5 job. They've been stable for a number of years.
All right,
they got reliable transportation.
Let me ask you a question: How much money do you make off of each one?
We have to look at. Depends on what you got.
Give me an example. What would you make a month off of one of those type of homes?
All right, now, not me, but there's a couple of brothers on the club.
If I was to get involved with this, how much money? Well, L.A., you got to let me say what I got to say.
No, you asked me a question. I'm trying to answer it. Okay. Me personally, I haven't done any business with
you. Let me ask the question. I'm talking about myself.
Right,
I got $100,000.
Okay.
Right here.
You got $100,000.
So how much money do I make once I make the investment for whatever that type of homeless person you talk about? You say there's plenty out there. How much will I make off of them a month?
Well, it depends on what kind of investment you set up.
Give me a mediocre.
There are plenty of people out there that are homeless, working homeless, that they spend.
I make $100 a month off of them?
Disposable income, put a roof over their head.
Would I make $100 a month off of them? $200 a month?
Yes, yes, and yes.
And so I make about
$200 a month.
All right, let me put these numbers together. $200 a month. I need $16,000 a month to live. Just to live.
That's you, though.
I told you me. I ain't tell you nobody else. I got the $100,000.
Okay. So
I have $100,000. Wait a minute. I have $100,000 to make an investment in this. That's me. Others don't have $100,000. They may have $10,000. So when you do the numbers on me with $100,000 and what I got to do with it, The ones that's got $10,000 ain't going to be able to do that with it.
All right, well, what as I'm you always say, and I agree with you. Bianchi, I agree with you on this point. The first thing that you say, and I agree with you on this, the first thing you do, you got $100,000 to spend, or to invest, really, that's the better word. Then you got to, once again, think on paper, and if it works on paper, you go forward with it. But if it doesn't work on paper, you don't go for it. You got to work it out on paper first. I agree with you on that part of it. If it doesn't work, whether it be $10,000
or $15,000, to make my $15,000. See, when we get to talking about the reality, nobody want to talk about that. They always want to talk about these possibilities. And I'm not saying you, because a lot of people do it, and use these motivational speeches. But that is one in a zillion. Tyler Perry sat in his car, slept in his car. How many people do that? I have the opportunity to do that. If you get one out of a zillion, that's doing pretty good. So these possibilities sound good, but when you do the numbers, they don't work. I need 75 people without even paying for the management. Because even though you're paying taxes, even though you own these properties, you talk about these different states. If you own property in these different states, you can't be in all those states. You have to manage that. That's more expensive.
Or so have a partner boots on the ground in those locations.
You say you got boots on the ground, I mean you got volunteers, right?
All right, for instance, the house in D.C., I got somebody. I'm showing that house Sunday. I'm not going to be. I got somebody in D.C. to show the house.
Let's don't get away from that. If you saying you got boots on the ground, well, hell, then you saying you got people that's going to do it for nothing. So how in the heck I'm going to get people to do something for nothing in order to satisfy 75 units? It ain't going to work.
Well, if you got 75 units and you got boots on the ground partners in all those 75 locations, that's the partnership. They're getting something out of that whenever you're going to rent it or lease it or sell it.
You're
not taking 100%. If you got a partner, the partner is sharing in the risk and the responsibility and the reward.
Let me ask this question. You know, the one gentleman said they're building 30-story. Well, that's my business, what I've done. But if I got people out there building, I have a liability in those people. If somebody gets hurt, I have to be able to cover the liability, and that costs money, a lot of money. So there ain't going to be no boots on the ground, because if boots on the ground get hurt, you're going to be liable for it. They lose an arm, a finger, a eye. It don't work like that.
That's why they have a thing called insurance. Once again, going back from your school of thought on this, and I'm with you on this. The bottom line is, before you get into any venture, and I agree with you on this because you brought it up before I did, you think on paper first. You write down all the concerns. You put down some figures. If it doesn't work out on paper first, you just don't get involved in that transaction.
Well, it ain't gonna
just
work.
Like
this.
There's a business board game called Cash Flow by a guy named Robert Kiyosaki. He's a pretty well-known author. Wrote a couple of books, at least one book with Trump. And the book Cash Flow, the board game Cash Flow, what Kiyosaki says is essentially what you're saying too. He says by playing the board game Cash Flow, you make your mistakes during the game. Find out where you're weak, where your flaws are, where your weaknesses are in your thinking or philosophy, and then from that,
go think on paper, and then
do your transactions.
Listen to this.
And he's got 12,000. He's got 12,000 partners.
You want some land? I can tell you where you can get 750 square miles of land right now, LA. Free. I can show you, I can get you 35,000 hectares of land right now. Now, what you going to do with it?
Well,
and see, here's the point. Wait a minute.
My problem is land. I'm the one throwing the maps out on the internet. I'm the guy that puts out. How many other people
put
that
you
hear on the podcast
talking
about? No one
here.
It's easy to get land.
Wait a minute, man.
It's easy to get land.
You've been, I've been holding on for 45 minutes to say this little stuff.
Okay,
all this land is available, and all this land is vacant. You know why? Because nobody want it. Nobody's going to be moving in them spots. Nobody. See, you don't have roads. You got dirt roads. How long can you drive? Hang on for a second. Hang on for a second. How long can you drive on dirt roads before they become ruts? Then now you got to repair them. Who's going to repair them?
All right, now
those are pipe dreams. Those are pipe dreams. When you try to put that into reality, it don't work.
Okay. Now, how do you explain this? Every big town that you can think of right now, from New York, Mumbai, or Bombay, what it used to be, Shanghai, Houston, St. Louis, name any town of any large size on a mega level. Every one of those towns, including Chicago, started with one person. Everything starts with one.
What year
Everything
was that?
Starts with one.
What year was that?
Well, it all depends. I mean, just
What year was that? The only year I know right now is 2020. The only year I know right now is 2023. So what year was that?
Okay.
St. Louis, Chicago, New
Four
York.
Months ago. All right, hold on, wait. 4 months ago on this very podcast that we're talking on right now, I had three young ladies from Metro Atlanta. They ran across 97 acres 2 hours outside of Atlanta with no money. They went back and talked to their friends, and they came up with 19 families, and they bought the 97 acres of land. Now they're up to 502 acres of land. The name of the town that they're doing is called Freedom, Georgia. And there are other people doing it as well.
I told you, I can show you, get you 35,000 hectares of land this week. I think there's another place.
The point I'm making is, we're not going
to
get.
See, another thing, you guys don't listen to all the fine stuff. That's why some people start off and they get to this
particular spot. Everybody's not
going to
do everything.
Well,
everybody's
not
going to do everything.
That needs to be added into the discussion. It's only certain people that's going to do that, and they are far and few in between. They're not going to do it. That's why all that land out there in Nevada and out in Colorado is empty. You ain't the first, and you got people that's got big-time boo-too bucks. But you know, when you put it on paper, it's not feasible. They ain't going to do it. They're not going to do it because nobody's going to move out. Why would they move out there?
I wonder who said that about Las Vegas, which was sitting up in the desert with nothing on it.
That was a long time ago, but once again, you got new towns out in Las Vegas right now, so why come it not continue?
First thing that this country is relatively young. Okay, we're not even 250 years old yet. So, no, you're not going to get the lion's share of people that are going to be. Most people are sheep. Most people are not going to get to develop the skills. Most people are not going to have the vision. Most people, if you give them a place to stay, a source of income, and we're social creatures, you know, we're talking about the pioneers that go out and do this kind of stuff. All right?
Not everybody's a pioneer. I applaud somebody for doing it. But what I'm telling you, when you talk about a businessman, I had a person this last week. I got the email. They need $300 million to do a project in Ivory Coast, a hospital.
Uh-huh.
A hospital in Ivory Coast. I said, I think it's $300 million, maybe $100 million. I forget. I asked him, I say France have carte blanche over the Ivory Coast. So how are you going to assure yourself that this is going to be proper? Then not only that, who's going to pay for to come stay in the hospital? The people in that area do not have that type of disposable income. In some of the hospitals they got now, when they go to the hospital, they got to carry their own mattress. Their family got to bring them food. They don't have those services. You can build a modern hospital, it's just going to sit there. Nobody's putting no $100 million out in something that have to stand around and nurse it and babysit it in order to get their money. But they want their money back right away.
Some do, some don't.
Well, the some that do, the some that don't ain't got the money. It's just like with these homeless. How are you going to make money? How are you going to make money off of, how can I make money off of homeless people other than through something that's charitable? And that don't have no guarantee. Come and go.
Let me ask that question directly, what you just said. There's a couple of brothers that they're on Clubhouse every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that's what they do. One started off as a social worker. He found a way to make money with the homeless by providing housing for the homeless. And now he's got him and his brother teach other people how to do it.
Who's paying for the homeless? Homeless ain't got no money to pay no rent.
Well, the way he breaks it down, that these homeless people, typically the common denominator is they all have social workers and they all get a check. And from the check, they rent them beds or they rent them rooms and houses that they set up. One has been able to quit his job, the other one still has. And they teach other people how to do that. I'm not in that business.
If somebody wants to do that, then say, let me tell you. On the National Society of Black Engineers website right now, where they try to prepare black children for the STEM jobs. I mean, if you got it, they will pay. They got over 6,000 jobs on there. At one point, I've seen as high as 11,000. And I'm not talking about jobs that was posted 10 years ago. Some of these jobs were just posted last week. I started them off with about $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. I think that would be a more formidable way to get people involved where they can make a high wage and salary. That way they won't be homeless. The best thing to do for homelessness is don't be one.
Would you agree? That blueprint that you just gave out, for some people, that will work. I mean, there's no one silver bullet that's going to work for everybody. People just have to see what's on the menu,
See, you know one thing about doctors. Doctors treat ailments. Engineers come up with solutions where you don't have that ailment no more. So what would you rather do? Treat the ailment, or you would rather come up with a solution where the ailment never exists again?
I can't answer that question. I can say this. There are things that are happening right now in 2023 that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, definitely 100 years ago, that people just marvel at. I mean, we got flying cars out here, driverless cars out here, planes that fly themselves. You know, running water, inside plumbing. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson's, over half the presidents of the United States never had experience indoor plumbing. Electricity. If you look at the history of mankind, the bulk of the history of mankind never experienced turn on a light switch. We just come going down the line. So think about it. Look at the people that were laughed at, like Henry Ford. He was laughed at. Ray Kroc, some DA tried to prosecute him when he was franchising when he first started.
Talking about, what you're talking about is breakthrough.
What I'm talking about is learning how to build
innovation.
What I'm talking about is learning how to build your own house. It's as simple as that.
Nobody's got time. My grandson
No.
Hang on for a second. No, hang
People
on for
have
a
the
second.
Kind of time no, they want to no, make.
Nobody that's got a profession is going to come home and build a house. It's not possible. You got to work. You got to spend time in your profession. You got to get rest. They ain't coming home with building no house. You know what Kurt Taylor is doing now?
Let me put it from my perspective. From the people that I've met, going to tiny house retreats, including myself.
Okay. Tiny houses. If you got a family in L.A., you can't be listening, though. If you got two or three or four kids,
I played audio on this podcast, and you can go type in on YouTube tiny house families. You will see families that live in tiny houses. It's not for everybody, but there's no stored to YouTube videos of tiny house families.
Barrington Downs, Barrington Downs, Missouri, which is about 3 miles from Ferguson, where Mike Brown got killed, is it's 80% black. The average house in that community is about $750,000. None of those people physically built those houses themselves. It's
look, another map I done put up. The Amish community on the regular do it. The Mennonites regularly do it. The Hoodinites regularly do it.
Amish and Mennonites are isolated
communities. And they're not building tiny houses.
All right, let me ask you a question about the Amish. Let me ask you a question about the Amish. Do they have cell phones? Do they have TVs?
Some do, most don't.
They have it for an emergency. The typical Amish person don't have no cell phone. They don't have no TV. They don't have these luxuries that those people over in Barrington Downs
and
have.
Some of those
black families got robots that stand by 5'6", 5'7", that do chores in the house. So what I'm saying is that when people talk about these things, you need to be more descriptive and say it. This ain't for everybody. And this is unusual. In many cases, it's a hobby. There's nothing wrong with that. I got a friend that's out in the wilderness in Alaska. The only way you get into their place, you got to fly in and land on a lake. That's perfectly fine. That's what they want to do. She left it, and the otters moved in and tore up the old house, so she had to build a new one. It was tore up by otters. When she go out, she has to have a dog because the dog can hear and sense bears and wolves, and she has to be armed. But it's perfectly fine. That's what they want to do. It's a whole lot of that's what they want to do.
I said that, my Piyaki. Now, you listen to me enough. I have said several times, off the grid living is not going to be suitable for the majority of the population. I was a on the grid guy, but then when I made a trip over to Europe for the first time, I went over there and then discovered new lifestyles and renewable energy, and you know, you can live this way and that way. Then I gradually just changed my lifestyle and all that. But the majority of the people that live in New York or any major metropolitan area know the majority of people, they're not going to do it.
No, they're not going to do it. I'm happy they don't, because we need
One of the reasons why they're not going to do it is because they haven't been exposed to anything. There are people that live in St. Louis. I'll use Washington, D.C. There are people that live in southeast Washington, D.C. that haven't been to the west side of D.C. And D.C. is not that big, physically speaking, geometrically speaking. They just live on one little comfort zone. They can't. All they know is their maybe 5 square radius patch of land wherever they're at. That's it. That's all they know, and that's all they want to know. All right, but.
A lot of people that
might be living in tiny houses, might be living in cars, might be living in a box truck that they converted into a tiny house, a lot of those people were forced in. They had to learn it.
If people in their 20s have 4 kids, at what point in time do you think in their lifespan do you think that they would get out of that square footage structure to go into a tiny house if they're going to be functional? Because when they become grandparents, they still have to be there to add the intergenerational assets for their grandkids.
Wait a minute. That's a good thing you're putting out there. Most people are not even thinking that way. Most people are trying to get through past Friday. They're not thinking about 200 or the next generation, the generation out there. Most people are not thinking that way. Some are.
Well, would it be more beneficial for society to get more people to thinking in a functional lifestyle? What you have for real grandparents, not 35-year-old, is which is a better grandparent, one that's 35 or one that's 65?
You know, that's a good question.
Well, it shouldn't
that's
be
a
more
very
than
good question.
There's
too many variables that we haven't included.
It shouldn't be. How long do you think that you have to contribute to an equity?
Are we talking about a 35-year-old grandparent that lives in New York City, Chicago, or a 35-year-old grandparent that lives in rural Uganda?
What have a 35-year-old grandparent that has tangible? What do they have tangible that they can offer to their grandkids?
Well, it depends on where they live. It depends on where they live and their lifestyle. Okay, if you have a 35-year-old grandparent that lives in rural Kentucky or rural Kampala in Uganda, all right, where they've built and the family house is paid for, the land is.
I know 35-year-old grandparents in St.
Land.
Louis. I know 35-year-old grandparents in St. Louis. We're not going to go to
The 35-year-old grandparents that you're going to meet in St. Louis, Chicago, there's no shortage of them in any big city. That's why I always bring up geography. You're living in the wrong space. If you're 35 years old and you're a grandparent, you can't tell grandparents or anybody, you can't tell people where to live, but it's just a suggestion. That's why we have this podcast. You know what? If you're struggling in St. Louis, you might want to look at a rural county in the state of Missouri, and you might want to consider, as a grandparent, taking up some carpentry classes.
They can't survive in city of St. Louis. They got running
water.
They can. They got electricity. They got sugar.
Here's how they can.
Just to say that they are 35-year-old grandparents tells a whole lot about the functionality of the family.
Well,
I got to get a bigger man.
Wait a minute. My grandmother on my mother's side,
I'm not talking about me, L.A.
She was 15 and got married and had 7 kids.
I'm not talking about you, and we're not talking about me. We're talking about general population. And also, they're grandmother, but they ain't married. Never been
Once
married.
Again, we have to look at the geography of where they are and the culture which they grew up. Show me a 35-year-old grandparent their 35-year-old grandparents in the Amish.
We're not talking about the Amish. That's an isolated condition. We're talking about typical urban life.
Well, if you're living in an urban environment, more likely you don't have the skills to stay in that urban environment.
You're damn right you don't have the – what is the picture of the criminality in your urban city? What is the face? What's the sex?
Well, it all depends on the city.
It's the black male. It's the black male.
Wait a minute, Piaggio. Hold on, let's slow down. Hold on. If we're in Louisville, Kentucky, that demographic is going to turn to somebody who has white skin.
I said an urban city. Your urban city. Your St. Louis.
Louisville, Kentucky, urban.
Well, let's talk about. I'm talking about that which let's say St. Louis, North St. Louis City, North St. Louis County. The typical face of the criminality. And the criminality age is the black male. Now that's what it is. Now why it is? Wait a minute. Why it is can be a thousand different points. But the reality of it is that's what it is. City of St. Louis once upon a time had over 100,000 students in their public school system. Now it's down less than 20,000. That's telling a story. People's down and denigrate redlining. Redlining is good. You know why? Because it tells you where not to buy a house. It tells you where not to put your kids to school. It tells you where not to drive your car because you're going to have exuberant insurance rates. It tells you where not to hang out. Not to walk down the streets. So don't you think that information is very, very, very beneficial?
Yes, that information is very beneficial. And
you're damn right it is.
We know it is. Everybody needs to know it. And, you know, I've been sitting here listening to everything you've been talking about. And, you know, one of the things that you said is you knew where 350 square miles of land was. It was for free that nobody wants. I would like to have the address to that, and I want it.
That's so, 750 square miles. It's an area called River G in Liberia.
Okay, that's fine. I've got people in Liberia. Now, you said there's some other land. Now, we want that too. You know, I've been working with countries all over the world. I'm working with more countries across the world than I am states in the United States. So the thing is people do want more. But the one thing is we don't make up anyone's mind. Every person on earth is a creator of their own. Now, we do make up people's mind for them because we make decisions that's going to affect them. And they make the decisions that's going to affect you. The difference is in them urban developments, that the way things are is because it has been put that way for that community to be complacent, to see if they would follow in. And we don't want that. We want our children to not ever have to experience what is going on right now and their children. And the way we can do that is involve the children and give them a purpose. And, you know, you said you had $100,000. You know, how could you turn that into making money and helping the homeless at the same time? If you took that and you built five houses that would house 2 to 3 beds in each one. And that's not spending a lot of money. It's $100,000 on five houses that would sleep 2 to 3 beds. Just for the 2 to 3 beds, we could get $800 a month each. So now each one of those, $2,400 a month. Now, if you want to talk about, you know, bringing the services that actually continue to, these people don't stay. This is a movement. This is a transitional housing situation. And I know that this legislation was in place because I was helping being involved to put it in place. But, you know, if we need to utilize what we have, and one thing that has propelled those urban developments to where they are is because of Section 8. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you know what Section 3, because I know you've listened to the show, and I've mentioned it. So have you ever heard of Section 3?
Yes, I've heard of the middle of Section 8, sure. And did you say Section 3?
Okay.
No, he said Section...
Yes, Section 3.
Section 3.
I never heard of Section 3.
Okay, Section 3 was created in the 60s. And Section 8 was after that, because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, correct? So they came up with a way, before they came up with a way to hold the community in place, they came up with a way to excel the community. But they didn't push that. And no entity in this country that works with Section 8 has ever heard of Section 3. Section 8 has a waiting list. Section 3 don't. Section 8 says you can only make this much money or you lose your benefit. Section 3 says you don't. Section 3 says you can get on-the-job training. You can go to school for training. You can get a better job. You can work a job and still not lose benefit, because it is something to empower you. So we are going to and educate the country.
Let me tell you what I know about Section 8. I can tell you how it got started, where I know it. Let me explain this. Section 8, for instance, in the St. Louis City, where one time you had Jews that owned the six-family apartment buildings, whether the Silvers, the Michelsons, the Coatners, the Eagle Realty. Well, what happened is this. People moved out of those and they left them for blacks, okay? And they was going to tear them down. But the government came to them with a plan. And they say, well, here's the deal. We're not going to be the landlord because these people don't pay. You got to guarantee us that we're going to get our money. Plus, you got to guarantee us if they tear up a unit, you're going to repair it. They said, okay, the government did. That was your Section 8. That's how it works. That's how it started,
yes, sir.
I should say.
That's how it started.
But gentlemen, hold on. Chris, hold on. Before we got booted out. 626, you there? 262.
262, this is Reba. Yes, hi.
Yeah. Your mic is off. Yeah, go ahead, because I want you to get in before we get kicked off. Go ahead.
Okay, what an exciting conversation. So I am familiar with Section 3. I do also recall home to ownership program. I do, in my opinion, not enough people who were on Section 8 who had the home to ownership program. They a lot of them didn't want their own homes. There's responsibility that comes with that. So the education piece, it was similar to, and I don't know if it exists, because I never had Section 8 or anything. I was a homeowner, and it was just really interesting how a lot of people, even a family member, you know, she was excited about it at one point to have the opportunity to get her own home. So everything from building credit to the education piece, financial literacy. Of course, with Section 8, you have to keep the home that you're literally renting. Well, the state and the government is renting it for you. A lot of people were struggling. I know someone, actually years ago when Section 8 was first introduced, the copay was $40 a month. That person did not pay the $40 and lost their Section 8. It's just really interesting. So a lot of people who have access to resources, because when I was struggling with my mortgage, I had to tell a few people, no, I have a real mortgage. I don't have Section 8, you know, and it wasn't to boast, but it was like, you know, to compare my struggle to theirs. And no, I'm paying a real mortgage. And I just, you know, I was just trying to engage parents, but they didn't really care about the community too much. One parent told me, this was actually an aunt of a student at Bogan High School, was trying to kick the young man out. And I was explaining, you know, certain rights that students have and families have. And so the mother was like, oh, well, my daughter, I'm just going to move. I got Section 8. I'm going to move out of the community anyway. So the accountability piece just needs to be, you know, firm when it comes down to anyone receiving public benefits, you know. And the Section 8 home to ownership program should be, if they're living, I'm talking about some luxury across the nation, people are living in some luxury homes. I'm not hating. What I am saying is, how many years do you get to do that? Because I understand that Section 8, you can pass it on to your children, things like that. I think that just should be some structured accountability. You know, you meet these marks, otherwise then you're not going to be homeless, but then you go back to the projects or something. You don't get to keep staying into a home, and you're not trying to meet these financial literacy goals, be it a class, you get certification and things like that. I think that people have been on these programs for so long, I feel that they should be able to teach somebody else some financial literacy, how to take care of a home, how to take care of a yard. It shouldn't just be on the landlord. Take care of that property where you're laying your head. Other than that, I know that we have some pessimistic viewers. I'm 50% most time. Most time, I lean more to an optimistic side. When it comes down to building tiny homes or teaching someone how to build, poor people did build their own homes. What did you call them? Shotgun homes. So poor people did. They found wood and they built their homes. For years and years and years, people have done it. One thing about it that you talk about, Brother LA, is social capital. So I believe in accountability. We're not planning on building our tiny homes for people to just get a free house. HUD doesn't even do that. That HUD program where they build houses, those people have to participate in building their homes. No, is it called HUD? What's that program where they build
Habitat
homes
for
people?
Habitat for Humanity is what it's called.
Habitat for Humanity.
Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah. So, you know, I just feel like, you know, hold people accountable to living the best of their lives, utilizing what abilities they have. Don't make them disabled when they're really not. Don't let people, because that's, to me, where the drug use and so forth, it just becomes extensive, and they're not trying to get help because they don't see any hope. So I appreciate you, Brother LA, for allowing me to speak and share, because what you, Chris, and others who are like-minded like myself, we know we have hope within us, and we know that people will. A student can't be a student unless they're willing to be taught. A teacher can't teach, rather. That's the quote. A teacher can't teach unless the student is ready to be taught. So when it comes down to
okay.
it, and I'm going to sum this up, you certainly want to work with people. I've learned as a philanthropist, even though I was never rich, I inherited some wealth. I've learned at the tender age, I'll be 53 next month, the reality is that everybody doesn't want help. But when they're ready to get help, they'll get help. So we're just going to put it out there in our circle and not a judgment call. However, I appreciate the Joliet Township putting those Section 8ers out who didn't own homes, and they were coming and they were tearing up the community. They were bringing the community down because as a previous homeowner myself, yes, it brings your property value down. And everybody don't appreciate something that's free because I don't feel like it's free. We're taxpayers. We pay for it. One other thing about people that get services through the state and the government, the federal government, they are taxpayers too, so they have to know their accountability, that they have a voice. I don't protest. I don't do walks. I know that when it comes down to protesting and boycotting, money talks. So if there are things that we want to change, and this is my last statement, like who's that, Dr. Claude Anderson? I'm not too privy to politics, but we just got our first black mayor, well, our second black mayor of Chicago. So we'll see if the mindset is the same, and it's not the skin color. It's actually just, you know, considering what we've gone through as a people across the nation. People say that because of politics is not going to change what has happened, but I do know that I'm educating people on their aldermen. The aldermen are the police supervisors. The aldermen are in charge of the police in each community. So that's something that we also need to educate people on, just the various things about where they live and their accountability, what rights they have. You don't have a right just because you're, you know, you have human rights. So if we say civil rights, that's why we're not getting heard you know, with the United Nations, because we keep talking about civil rights. Well, they don't consider a lot of groups of people, several groups of people, they don't consider them civilized. They consider them animals, animalistic. But if you're struggling, you're going to be a survivor in your community. If it's robbing people, you know, I can go on, but I just wanted to share that, and I thank you once again for letting me speak, and I appreciate your heart, Chris, as well, your heart. I appreciate the wisdom of your guests that I hear on the line. So there is wisdom. I listen to everything, and I use what I can use, and I store, you know, something for later use if possible to use it. Other than that, again, I'm optimistic, but I do know the realities of people who want help. They can be helped. So that's where I'm going to exert my energy.
All right. You got the last word for today. Thank you, Reba.
Okay.